This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Nicht warten, durchstarten mit Indeed. Beschleunige dein Recruiting jetzt auf indeed.com/julep. Mit einer Premium-Stellenanzeige wird dein Angebot ganz oben auf der Seite platziert. Für mehr Sichtbarkeit, damit du schneller die richtigen Mitarbeiter findest und einstellen kannst. Und das Beste, das alles funktioniert ohne monatliches Abo oder langfristige Verträge. Du zahlst nur für Ergebnisse. Sicher dir jetzt 75 Euro Guthaben auf eine Premium-Stellenanzeige auf indeed.com/julep. Es gelten die AGB.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast.
Hello and welcome to the programme. This morning we hear from the mother of the Royal Artillery gunner Jaisley Beck, who died by suicide. An inquest concluded that the Army's handling of a sexual assault complaint filed by Jaisley Beck played more than a minimal contributory part in her death. And that her mum, Leanne McCready, now wants to support others who speak out. If you have served in the military and you want to share your experience as a woman, please do get in touch. The number to text is 84844 on WhatsApp or 03700 100444. Also, this hour, Fatma Said, the Egyptian operatic soprano, will be with us. Fatma has a new album called Leader. It's focusing on German language songs of the Romantic era. She actually sings in six languages. Here's a little of her singing in Arabic with her performance of Masr Heya Omi. That performance, which is really quite something, I watched it online, has been watched 2.5 million times. We're going to talk about that and lots of other things too. Now, I want to know, have you ever walked into a room and clocked someone in the same outfit? Were you delighted or disgusted? I want to hear your stories. Maybe you had a laugh, or maybe you went to try and change, or perhaps you love twinning, wearing the same outfit as your good pal when you go out. The number to text 84844. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. For a WhatsApp message or a voice note, the number is 03700 100 444. And I ask that question because fashion influencers Laura Adlington and Lottie Drynan have a live show at the London Palladium coming up based on wearing the same dress on different bodies. So this started online, but it has since exploded in popularity. And we have Lottie and Laura joining me in the studio in the coming hour. So do stay with us for that. But we begin with the BBC board apologising over missed opportunities to tackle bullying and misogynistic behaviour by the former BBC Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood. An independent report into what the BBC knew about Mr. Westwood's conduct highlights a series of incidents and allegations it said amount to a considerable body of evidence which it failed to investigate properly. The BBC has previously acknowledged six complaints about bullying and sexual misconduct. In a video that appeared on social media last year, the DJ said it's all false allegations. Well, Chichi Azundu, BBC correspondent who's been covering this story for a long time, joins me now. Welcome to Woman's Hour, Chichi. For those that aren't familiar with Tim Westwood, how would you describe him?
So Tim Westwood was one of the most leading hip-hop DJs in the UK, particularly at a time when hip-hop wasn't considered a genre of music that most radio stations would play. He started out in the early 80s, then on pirate radio, then got a job at Capital Radio, still promoting hip-hop music. Then he got a job at Radio 1 and flourished. He, at one point, had millions of listeners across the world listening to his opinion about hip-hop music, and some of the biggest names in hip-hop music would only ever speak to him whenever they came to the UK. Such was his power in that genre of music. It's interesting because Tim Westwood, in case people don't know, is a white man, and he really, really was revered in the black community for how much he was highlighting positively hip-hop music.
You worked with Tim Westwood. You're in a particular position, actually, Chichi, because you did work with him and you have been the leading voice on this investigation within the BBC. For Tim Westwood, you read the news bulletins on his programme. I just want to play a brief exchange, which you're aware of, between you to give listeners an idea of this programme.
This is BBC Radio 1 Extra.
And that is correct. It's 5 o'clock, time for the BBC Radio 1 Extra News with Chichi Azonde. Yes. I mean, Chichi, you suffer from a rather perturbing camel toe most days, even when you're wearing a skirt. Are you interested in this lady product, which would help disguise that rather protruding, raging camel toe of yours?
I mean, I was gobsmacked listening back to that this morning. I'm wondering how you feel on hearing that.
It's weird. I'm in a really weird position because this story genuinely is not about me. That was during a Drive Time programme, which went out, as you heard, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on One Extra, which is considered a youth station for younger people. So the Ofcom rules around what you can and cannot say during that time are quite strict. But I was not the only newsreader that he made comment about bodily parts. I was not the only newsreader who he had a joke at their expense. And it always came either just before or just after the bulletin. And sometimes he would interrupt your bulletin, and that was really difficult. But that was how he operated.
And I should say that clip that I played is from the programme Behind the Stories, Tim Westwood, Behind the Investigation, which, of course, goes into some of these details that we're getting into now. But the allegations against him, what are they?
So the allegations from our investigation in 2002, we heard from 18 black women who alleged sexual misconduct, unwanted touching and predatory behaviour from Tim Westwood. He denied those allegations at the time and has done since. And the allegations in the report found that, like you just heard in that clip, he focused on people's bodies, particularly women's breasts, and often mocked people live on air. There was always a joke at their expense. There was accusations of bullying. There were more serious accusations that the report found, if they had been dealt with properly, could have been referred to police. There were accusations of making a toxic workplace for staff, so that staff were continuously moved around working from him. Some staff did not feel that they could go to BBC management and make a complaint because they revered the talent more than they revered the production staff. Those were the kind of allegations. And I'll say again, Tim Westwood didn't take part in the report, and he cited an ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation. But he did say through his lawyers that he denies the allegations.
And just to put this in a timeline for people, so he has been accused of unwanted sexual behaviour and touching in instance between 1992 and 2017. You investigated this in 2022.
Yes.
And you mentioned some of the aspects that are there. How did the BBC respond at that time?
So that was an interesting part of the investigation, because during my investigation, I put in a Freedom of Information request to the BBC asking about any complaints that Tim Westwood had against him. And they responded with, "We could neither confirm nor deny whether we hold that information." Then in April 2022, when the documentary went out, the BBC then came out with a statement. And then I think it was a week or two later, they found 6 complaints, one of which was referred to police. At the time of the broadcast of the documentaries, which are still on the iPlayer, if anyone wants to go and watch, they are quite a tough watch, so I just would want to warn people. Tim Westwood and his legal team said that he'd never had any complaints against him. But the BBC said, yeah, he had 6 complaints against him, some of which he'd been spoken to, one of which had been referred to police. So at the time, the BBC were looking through the records that they had, and this is what they uncovered.
So why we are talking about this today is because the BBC board has apologised over missed opportunities to
yes.
tackle bullying and misogynistic behaviour by Tim Westwood. Is there any specifics on why they talk about why it flew under the radar for so long?
I mean, this report, the independent report, was launched months after our investigation in 2022, it was hard to get people to come forward and talk to Gemma White Casey, who led the report. She did manage to speak to 120 people, so that's quite a lot. And it cost more than £3 million. There is a lot of criticism in this report for BBC management and how they handled complaints that were made to them or that came to them via the public. That might be one of the reasons why things flew under the radar. The BBC's, once again, the BBC's way of keeping records has come under scrutiny, as it did under the Hugh Edwards investigation last year and the year before. This time again, the record keeping of management and following through on things has been criticised. BBC management don't fare well. The senior levels of BBC management don't fare well coming out of this report.
And with the report, you mentioned there that it was carried out independently, as you talk about. Also, can you tell us a little bit more of any of the other findings that we should be aware of?
The other findings that you should be aware of. I'm still ploughing through this report because okay. It's nearly 170 pages long. Mm-hmm. The other findings that the BBC say happened are that the allegations were treated in isolation rather than being brought together. And the body of evidence, the considerable body of evidence that Gemma White Casey discovered, she says, had complaints been treated together, the BBC may have seen a pattern of evidence or a pattern of behaviour and taken action. She also said that she found that there were complaints and instances where, if they had been handled correctly, it would have called into question Tim Westwood's employment at the BBC.
And let me read a little off the BBC statement. The BBC board admitted it did not take adequate action, saying it's clear that in the past the BBC has not only been too siloed but too deferential to high-profile individuals. The board also wants to take this opportunity to apologise on behalf of the entire BBC to anyone impacted by what the review has found. Your voice has been heard, it says, and the findings of the review will further fuel the drive to ensure it does not happen again. To Tim Westwood, I know you were mentioning some of the aspects there, Chi-Chi. But he denies the allegations of criminal and other misconduct and confirms he has never had any sexual interest in children under the age of 16. He never acted in a predatory and or sexual manner and did not and does not present a risk to young women at the BBC nor elsewhere. He's been denied the opportunity, he says, of presenting a defence to allegations set out in the report as a result of the vague nature of the allegations and the ongoing police investigation, which you also mentioned, Chi-Chi. But how do you think, the reason that we're speaking about it this morning, the BBC's apology will go down with Tim Westwood's alleged victims?
I had a text this morning from someone who wishes to remain anonymous, and that person asked a really simple question. Does the BBC actually say sorry, or is it just in press releases?
Thank you for joining us. There's more on this story online. And as we mentioned as well, it can be a tough watch, but there is the programme behind the stories, Tim Westwood behind the investigation, Chi-Chi, who's continuing to plough through that report. Thanks very much for coming in to us. A lot of you are getting in touch with me this morning. I just mentioned dresses. I mentioned same dress, different bodies. At my sister's wedding, I was wearing the same dress as my future brother-in-law's niece. That was fine. However, her sister was wearing the same dress as my sister, the bride. We all found it very amusing and had photos together, though she did wear her cardigan more than perhaps she would have. Mm. Hillary, on a cruise some years ago, I wore a beautiful pale lime green evening dress. I'd bought it specially for the cruise and I loved it. The first time I wore it, I stepped out of my cabin at the same time as the lady in the cabin opposite me, and she was wearing exactly the same dress. We both smiled and said, I said, I hope I look as good in mine as you do in yours. Very gracious. 84844, if you want to get in touch. Lots of people with the same dress, different bodies. But that is the name of something that began when the fashion-loving friends and influencers Laura Adlington and Lottie Drynan realised they were both having problems finding clothes that they felt comfortable in. For Lottie, it was due to bloating caused by IBS. Laura was limited, she thought, by what she found available in plus sizes. So they began to film themselves trying on the same clothes. Lottie, a size 12, Laura, size 24. And those posts on Instagram became huge hits. And they've now turned the experience into a live show at the London Palladium, which is coming up. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to meet you, Laura. Lottie, welcome back. So talk us through, how did you first meet?
That's a funny story, but which we did check was okay to say on air first.
Most things that go ahead.
So I was working on a campaign for to promote smear tests, going to get gynecological tests, and I decided as part of the campaign I was going to create vulva-shaped cupcakes. Mm-hmm. And I put on my Instagram stories, I had an epic fail, and someone said, Laura, she was on Bake Off, she lives near you. So I slid into her DMs and messaged her and said, could you make me some vulva cupcakes for tomorrow? She said no. But then our friendship grew from there.
Good boundaries, Laura. And you can't say vulva on Woman's Hour. I don't know where you can
say it. There we go. Yeah.
So you became buddies. But how did this, habit that became an Instagram phenomenon of trying on the same clothes come about, Laura?
It's actually Lottie's idea. I think she messaged me randomly one day and said, I've got this idea. And you might think it's rubbish, but I wonder if like we tried on different clothes and see, you know, show what they look like on our different bodies, because we're so used to just seeing on like websites, on catwalks, in magazines, one body type. And so we really wanted to empower women to show them that actually you can like look good whatever your size, whatever your shape, whatever your age. And it kind of started from there, really. We did like a little try on of some summer
in your
dresses,
bedroom, wasn't in my it? Bedroom. Yeah. Never planned for it to go this far, but
no, it just kind of took off.
But with it, dopamine dressing, as I've heard it called as well, which both of you are this morning. Lottie's in a red dress and a leopard print jacket.
Yes.
Yeah, and we have Laura. She has a giant cherries on her t-shirt that she's wearing this morning as well. So very bright and colourful. But is it certain clothes that work for twinning?
I think what we've definitely discovered along the way is, as women, we've been told since we were younger that clothes are designed to make ourselves look smaller, or we use them to hide behind. And we've had so much fun playing around, because we're trying on the same dresses, but it'll be one day it'll be Laura's style or mine. We've had fun playing with our style and realised that actually style should be an extension of our personalities rather than just a uniform, which I think it's been seen for so long. Mm. Like we have the sort of, Laura talks about often, sort of as a plus size woman, just hiding behind the black hoodies and black leggings that so many of us relate to. So dopamine dressing has been a really fun thing for us to experiment with.
So that's a really fun phrase. The other one, you know, we often hear about body positivity, but you talk about body neutrality.
Yeah, I think
Laura.
A lot of people don't realise that body positivity was actually a political movement in the 60s. And it was about equal rights for fat women, for employment, for medical care. And then really it got kind of commercialised and taken over, and some would say whitewashed as well in the 90s. And so I think what people come to think of modern day body positivity is, oh, I must love my rolls. I must love my cellulite. Mm-hmm. I must love my big stomach and my hairy chin and my fupa. And actually, I think that for us isn't like realistic. And a lot of people don't really want to associate with that anymore. I certainly don't look in the mirror every day and love what I see. Whereas body neutrality is much more about function over form. So it's just, I have a body and how I look is the least interesting thing about me. Not always easy to do. Still have days, we both do, where we struggle. But actually leaning into body neutrality has really, really helped both of us.
You mentioned fupa. That's fat in the upper...
I don't know if I can say
pelvic. I'm saying pelvic. It's probably not pelvic.
Let's go with
area.
That.
We know the area.
I saw the team behind it. You said it.
And we all know the area we're talking about. It's not like the regular roll. It's the roll below.
The roll below that covers the... Yeah.
So let's... So you're making this into a show at the London Palladium.
I know, crazy.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, we did a pilot show last summer and it was so much fun. And we realised, even now, we've put reels together where we're looking at catwalks from London Fashion Week. Even in 2024, 2025, we're still seeing the same, just one size body. So we wanted to create something really different and basically bring women together to, for the first time, hopefully they go into summer feeling like they're good enough as they are. They don't need to change their body. They can experiment with style and have fun and just feel really empowered. So it's basically a combination of fashion, of female empowerment. We've got panelists. We've got a catwalk of 12 different women who are taking the same dress, different bodies, reels to life, all different shapes, sizes, abilities. They're just amazing. So everyone can feel represented.
It comes at such an interesting time because I feel, particularly over the past couple of weeks, perhaps it's the amount of, it's award season, so you have a lot of glamorous celebrities on red carpets, but also in the papers, people speaking about that skinny has kind of come back in, almost that 90s skinny, and we've talked about it here on the programme. Some of it, no doubt, because of weight loss drugs.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, in your field, is that something that people are talking about, or do you ever feel pressure?
Yeah.
Yeah, to be honest, I do. I can actually, I think when they first came out, I was quite anti them, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it's not black and white. I don't really like the way like the media is portraying like them as like skinny jabs or miracle cures and all of that. And I think what I don't like is, if I'm honest, the people that are taking them that don't really need them. It's not for the people that need to lose 10 pounds. But I do know friends that have been on them and have said they've been life-changing. And I think unless you've struggled with food addiction all your life and you're constantly surrounded by like, what am I eating? How much? Oh my God, I'm never full. I understand that they can be a real lifeline. And what worries me is that we are going back, as you say, to this kind of 90s heroin chic, and we're only seeing that one body type again. And if you don't fit that beauty standard and that mould, it can make you feel pretty rubbish about yourself. And that's what we don't want. And that's why we're doing the live show.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel you can get to a point of, say, acceptance, perhaps. But then if something comes into society that's turning that on its head again, it's quite a lot of stuff to think about. We have lots of messages coming in. Shall we do a bit of same dress, different bodies? Prue, back in the 60s, I was invited to a wedding and the fashion of the day, I bought a pink petal hat. When I arrived at the wedding, I found all six bridesmaids had the same hat.
Oh no.
You could have just slid right in there, Prue. Margaret, I attended a ball 50 years ago when a lady had the same dress. I felt really pleased with my look. The other lady was about the same age as I am now, over 80, and I just thought, good for you. Don't think I wore the dress again. I just got on and enjoyed the evening. Gosh, there's a lot coming in. Here's Hazel. My twin sister was getting married in Barbados, so we were having a special night out when we were there. I bought a lovely dress and told her I was going to wear it. I walked towards our meeting place and she came towards me in the same dress, in the same colour. We laughed all night but got some very funny stares, mainly because we were 50-year-old identical twins wearing the same dress.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
But, you know, you're doing it on your Instagram. Do you ever both go out dressed alike?
Yeah, all the time. This is probably the first time we haven't been.
I was kind of hoping.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, next time. Yeah. It is so lovely, though. And one thing we always say is, a lot of people in us, I guess, just it's ingrained in us, feel like, oh, the smaller person will look better. But it's so great us seeing, actually, there's so many styles that Laura looks so much better in. And it's just showing that style has no size.
And what do you find, particularly if you're a larger size, perhaps works better than the smaller size, Laura?
I think that's the whole thing we're about, is that actually you can just wear what you want, whatever brings you joy, whatever makes you comfortable. Like Lottie said earlier, I spent years and years hiding in black leggings and black T-shirts or a black smock top. So I think for me now, I just...
But what was the catalyst then? What was the change, Laura, that made you ditch the black leggings and the black sweatshirt, which I felt at the end of COVID, like lockdown, like, will I ever wear black again? But anyway, yeah, continue.
Well, I was actually going to have bariatric surgery.
Were you?
And so for about a year and a half, I didn't buy any clothes. And I decided quite last minute that I wasn't going to go down that route. And I'm pleased I didn't. I think it's right for some people. It wasn't right for me. But at that point, I sort of started to think, OK, what would my life be like if I wasn't constantly on a diet? I wasn't constantly chasing weight loss and thinking that, you know, my worth is tied to my weight. And I just, you know, I just started to experiment a little bit more with fashion and buy clothes that fit me and not just things that fit, but things that made me feel good.
That's a really interesting point, though. Buying the stuff that fits, right? Buying that size that perhaps is a bit bigger instead of trying to squeeze into something that is not actually the right size.
Yeah, the when I'm skinny wardrobe is depressing.
Yeah, I used to think my life would start when I was smaller. I literally would say, like, Laura version 2.0 will be better, happier, have, you know, more better relationships, like, I'll be a better friend, I'll travel more, I'll do so much more. And I really did put so much worth on that, like, number in my dress or my jeans.
But it's so interesting. So you decided not to have the surgery, and that was the turning point for you.
Yeah.
But what was the... Was there something before kind of deciding not to have that surgery?
I wonder how the
switch was flicked, if you know what I mean.
I think that was a real turning point for me. And actually, it was around the same time that I got invited to go on the Bake Off. And it was kind of like a...
Oh, wasn't that funny?
Yeah. But I'd always loved fashion. I just always felt like fashion didn't love me because I couldn't buy the clothes. I just really weren't out there. I think that's changed as well. As much as we moan, there's not loads of... you know, clothes around in both of our sizes. It is definitely better, isn't it, now?
Yeah, it's definitely got a lot better, even since something that I say that I realise the privilege that I have. I've always struggled to buy clothes with my bloating and find something comfortable. But since working with Laura on this series, I realise the fact that I can go into pretty much any store and take a piece of clothing off the hanger in my size. And it's so difficult to do that when you're over a size 16, which is the UK average women's sizing, but they just do not cater for it. And that's something that has really opened my eyes in this series. It has got better, but there's still only, we can count on one hand the amount of shops that we can shop in
that's
together.
Not mine. There's nowhere on the high street I can shop.
Why do you think that is, though? Because we're talking about high street mainstream.
Yeah.
Obviously would be a cash cow for people if that was available.
Yeah, we
don't understand it.
We do a confidence overhaul and go to different shopping centres across the country, and we get so many messages from women saying, I'd love to apply, but you won't be able to shop for me. They want our money, but shops just aren't listening.
And how do you understand the popularity of your twinning posts when you wear the same dress on different bodies?
Do you know what was one of the best moments for me was after our first show, we had messages from women saying, we came on our own to the show, we didn't know anybody, but here's a picture of us, and they've gone to wherever it is, M&S across the road, and they've taken photos in the changing rooms in all their different bodies. Wearing the same clothes, and that for me, I was like, this is really, really cool.
Nice. I think we get messages all the time saying that it's like our reels have really inspired and empowered women to, you know, ditch the fashion rules, and they thought, like you said earlier, like that everything would just look better on you, and that it's really changed their confidence, and that's our why, isn't it? That's why we do it. It means a lot to us.
Yeah.
One more comment. Lucy, age 21, I was invited to a friend's wedding. A skin student, I bought a cheap new dress in a popular high street shop, a slinky long black number. I was mortified to discover when the ceremony began that the couple had chosen the same dress for the adult bridesmaids. We have a theme here. I had to spend the day explaining that no, I wasn't supposed to be taking photos with the wedding party or sitting at the top table or dancing with a groomsman. Lots of the
Back
stories coming in. Enjoy the London Palladium on the 23rd of March when Same Dress, Different Bodies will be live with Lottie Drynan and Laura Adlington. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Now, if you didn't catch Woman's Hour earlier this week, you will have missed a great interview with the Nigerian-American sci-fi novelist Nnedi Okorafor. Her book, Death of the Author, has just been released, and she told me on Monday that she took up writing after she was temporarily paralysed following surgery. Here's a brief part of that interview.
I played semi-pro tennis from the age of 9. I was also a track star. I did the 400, the mile, the high jump, all of that. And I loved athletics. That was my thing. And it ended when I had to have surgery for my scoliosis, and there were complications. And that complication was that I woke up paralyzed from the waist down, and essentially ended
up... What age were you there in that age?
I was 19. It was traumatic. It was sitting in a hospital bed where I discovered storytelling. It was literally that. I was just going into a dark place, and I just started writing this story to myself. And that was when I discovered storytelling, and I haven't stopped writing since. So I had to relearn how to walk, all of that. And so when I wrote Death of the Author, and I have this character, Zelu, in a lot of ways, she is based on me, even though she's different. One of the things that I do when I'm writing is I go into those dark crevices. I go down those dark roads. In this case, I was thinking about if I had never been able to walk again, what would life have been like? That's how I came to Zelu being paraplegic.
It's so interesting because I often think of science fiction or fantasy as writing about what ifs.
Yes, very much so. That is often my inspiration to writing science fiction as well, that question of what if. It's a very
powerful,
fertile.
Just expansive. Anything can happen. Anything can happen. You can listen to the full interview on BBC Sounds that I had with Nnedi Okorafor by searching for Monday's programme. Now, you may, like me, have been drawn to the smiling photos in the newspapers of the young soldier Jaisley Beck. But behind those pictures is a story of a young woman who joined the army with great pride, but suffered sexual assault and harassment and who killed herself in December of 2021. Last week, the assistant coroner, that's Nicholas Reinberg, ruled at her inquest that the 19-year-old, who was a Royal Artillery gunner, died by suicide. She was found dead in her barracks at Larkhill Camp in Wiltshire in December of 2021. As I mentioned, it was after a Christmas party. Mr. Reinberg said the Army's handling of a sexual assault complaint played, and I quote, more than a minimal contributory part in her death. Jaisley Beck had filed a sexual assault complaint against Battery Sergeant, that was Major Michael Webber, who she said had pinned her down while attempting to kiss her during a training exercise at Thorny Island in Hampshire in July of 2021. It was recorded as inappropriate behaviour, unbecoming of a warrant officer. Also, in the 2 months before her death, she was subjected to relentless harassment by her line manager at the time. That was former bombardier Ryan Mason. Now, he sent over 4,600 messages confessing his feelings for her, he said, and showed her a 15-page love story that he had written detailing his fantasies about her. The Army's failure to take action contributed to her death, the coroner ruled, and the Army said more should have been done to protect her. Jaisley had always been desperate to join the army. Through her mother, Leanne McCready, she has revealed, Leanne, that she tried to discourage Jaisley from joining the army. But thinking back to those beautiful photographs of her daughter, I asked Leanne what Jaisley was like.
She was everything that I could possibly ask for in a daughter. Kind, considerate, polite, such a huge part of his family, always wanting to do best for others. Just a ray of sunshine, really. Really, such an amazing girl.
What we also see, as she has this beaming smile, that she is wearing her uniform, which, of course, is what this story is centering on as well. But what did life in the army mean to her?
It meant a lot. She really was a proud soldier. She wanted to achieve goals, and which she did. She wore a uniform with pride. She made us proud. Yeah, life in the army for her was great up until the events,
which are so heartbreaking. There has been the conclusion of the inquest. How are you doing? How are your family doing?
We're still taking time to process everything, mm-hmm. But we feel in Jaisley's memory that we've achieved so much. And our aim now is to support others, and hopefully other people will speak up after hearing our story.
And with that sense of achievement that you talk about, does it give you solace?
Would I say it gives us solace? I think to be able to hear the army say we have failed your daughter, after blaming us as a family in their service inquiry, that absolutely gives us solace.
Because when we spoke to you last, Leanne, it was in 2023 and you had already been fighting for answers for such a long time. You are her mum. Can you tell us a little bit about how you keep that resilience to keep fighting for her?
Because I know, had it have been anybody else, Jaisley would have been sat exactly where I am now and speaking up for our family. And that keeps me going. She was strong, she was determined, and she was a fighter. So unfortunately, Jaisley's not here to tell her story now, but I'm here to tell her story.
And you talk about that strength of character that she had, which she must have had because she was so young when she joined the army, right?
She was
16. How did you feel when she came to you and said, listen, Mum, I have a career decision?
I obviously tried to discourage her. For her to say on the back of a school careers day, Mum, I'm joining the army. Like, no. But it's my job as a mum to support them, to guide them and not take away both my children's decisions. Yes, it did come as a bit of a shock that she was wanting to join the army, but she, bless her, she did. She did everything she could in order to get in, and she succeeded. Was I happy? No. But again, we all supported her as a family. I kept asking her along the way, are you sure you don't want to change your mind? But no, she was strong-minded and she said, no, Mum, this is what I'd like to do.
So obviously a very happy young woman in this new career. But when did you realise then that things were not okay with her?
It was up until the event that took place in Thorny Island. She instantly called and said exactly what had happened and how she was discouraged to report this. And when I asked, what do you mean you were discouraged? Because it did take a lot for her to report this. And she just said, Mum, they kept putting pressure on me by reminding me that this man, who she wasn't familiar with, she was told just to, you know, just to bear in mind he's married and he has got a loving family. And if you do report this, then this could lead to him losing his job and possibly causing his marriage to break down. So that is a lot of pressure to put on her.
And she had, to give a little more details with what you're discussing, Leanne, that she had made a sexual assault complaint against a senior sergeant, Battery Sergeant Major Michael Weber, following that incident, which wasn't properly dealt with, as you talk about there. Summing up at the inquest, Mr. Reinberg said, on the balance of probabilities, she was sexually assaulted by Weber and it should have been reported to the police, and the failure to do so breached army policy. He is still serving. It's been reported that he intends to leave. She was later then subjected to relentless harassment by her line manager, that was Bombardier Ryan Mason, over a 2-month period before her death. And I want to put this in perspective for those listening. He sent her over 4,600 messages and 3,600 messages in the month before she died. He has since left the army at his own request. Concluding the Salisbury inquest on Thursday, Mr. Reinberg said there had been a systemic failure by the army to report harassment that she suffered at the hands of her manager before her death. And she didn't make a complaint about his behaviour. How do you understand why she did not make a complaint at that point, Leanne?
We know that the reason why she didn't make this complaint is because of how the complaint was handled with the BSM, Michael Weber. Her words to me, Mum, was, Mum, what's the point? They didn't do anything when I was sexually assaulted. Why will they do anything with this? I don't want to be known as a female troublemaker in the army.
That word troublemaker as well, it's something that comes up a number of times when we...
Yes, and she's already been called back when she put the statement in. She'd already been called a liar by her senior.
We understand when Bombardier Ryan Mason realised his messages, this is that the thousands of messages were upsetting. He is said to have texted your daughter to inform her he was removing himself from his post. He wrote, after what you said, I'm only doing this to make sure you can continue as normal and keep on the upwards path that you were on. But so sadly, a few days later, she was found dead in her room. After concluding that Jaisley had died by suicide, Nicholas Reinberg, who we mentioned, the assistant coroner for Wiltshire and Swindon, listed factors which contributed to her decision to take her own life. He said the factors which contributed to her death were failure on behalf of the army to take action in relation to the harassment that Jaisley was suffering at the hands of her line manager, failure on behalf of the army to take appropriate action against the officer at whose hands she suffered sexual assault. That is, I'm sure, very difficult to hear, Leanne. I'm just wondering what goes through your mind as I read it again.
Again, I don't think we've processed even what was said at the inquest. Although we were there every day for 2 weeks, again, it's hard to process. And knowing what we knew as a family, and how we was trying to guide her. It's heartbreaking to hear those words that the army was at fault, because that will never bring our daughter back. So as many sorries they send, our daughter will never, ever return.
I also have a statement. This is from Brigadier Melissa Emmett, who's the head of Army Personnel Services Group. And she said, on behalf of the Chief of the General Staff, I wish to extend the Army's deepest condolences to Jaisley's family and friends and to offer them our sincerest apologies for the failings that the coroner has identified during this inquest. We should have done so much more to support and protect her. The 3 years since Jaisley's sad death have seen significant changes in the army, including the introduction of clear and unequivocal policies to state that there will be zero tolerance to the unacceptable sexual behaviours. These changes are being embedded throughout our culture, policies and enduring practices across every part of the army. Your other daughter, Emily, has been speaking out. She said on the Today programme that the army is not a safe space for women and would not advise women to join. Would that be your view?
I don't think it is a safe space for women. No, I'm not saying all men are the same. Absolutely not. But it's male dominated in the army. And it's power. It's power. Those that Jaisley complained to, it's all males. And unfortunately, as you know, the outcome shows, Jaisley didn't stand a chance. She wanted her voice to be heard. And I think one of the soldiers' words was, it got squashed.
You will have probably seen and heard the stories that women have been sharing of being raped, abused or harassed while serving in the military as the inquest was taking place. There were posts uploaded anonymously to social media, and they include allegations of women being pinned to the floor by male officers, as well as reports of men trying to force their way into female colleagues' rooms. You mentioned to me earlier that, you know, you want to be that voice for others that might be going through what Jaisley went through. So I'm wondering, when, because the volume of responses is astounding.
It really is. And as I've said to people personally and online on social media, I am so proud of those who have spoke up, and I cannot thank people enough for the support they've given in Jaisley's memory. And my voice can start a conversation, but together we can make change. And already I've seen a change. And for those that have spoken up, honestly, be so proud of yourself. Be really, really proud of yourself, because we're sat here, our little family, and we do read the posts. And I just think, wow, well done. Well done to everybody that have now spoke up on the back of our story of Jaisley. From day one of the post that I'd put out on social media, over 700 people spoke up. And that is incredible. That is absolutely incredible. And to know that they have got the confidence now to do so again, they should be so proud of themselves, because I do not want any other family or soldier to go through what we're going through. I wouldn't wish this upon anyone. So therefore, I will continue to be Jaisley's voice. I do put on social media, I hope that in a positive way for them, they can engage with my words and have the ability to, again, to stand up to these, to the males in the army.
Jaisley's case is one, but I want to put this in context for a moment, because there has been a string of allegations against the armed forces. If we look at 2022, Sophie Brooke, a female member of the armed forces, blew the whistle on sexual harassment in the submarine service. In May last year, here on Woman's Hour, we heard from a female officer who said she was raped by a more senior officer in the Royal Navy. She told us, while he has been permitted to continue his career, hers had been ruined. There was a damning parliamentary inquiry in 2021, led by the former MP Sarah Atherton, in the year that Jaisley died, that found that 64% of female veterans and 58% of currently serving women reported experiencing bullying, harassment or discrimination during their careers. The inquiry also heard evidence of sexual harassment, sexual assault and rape experienced by service women. You talk about some of the change, women speaking up, but how do you think on the other side the armed forces can protect the women who are in the ranks?
I believe an independent body needs to investigate the most severe cases. The army shouldn't mark its own homework because look what's happened. So changes, instant changes need to be made there, and I will continue to fight for that.
I want to read a little to you, Leanne, of a statement for the government. This is the Minister for Veterans and People, Alistair Cairns, who said, Jaisley was a young and promising soldier who should have had the opportunity to thrive in a supportive and safe environment. Her death was and still is a tragedy, and we're deeply sorry for the failure to protect her. There's no place for any abuse or unacceptable behaviours within the military. The government has stepped up efforts to bring about crucial reform and provide a place where people are proud to work and have faith in the service justice system. We will honour Jaisley's legacy by ensuring this is done in the shortest possible time and in the most effective manner. Your response?
It's comforting to know that other people are supporting and speaking up. But then again, it needs to go back to the independent body. The army cannot mark its own homework.
That was to be my question, whether you have faith in the service justice system.
No.
What happens next for you?
We will be writing to the police and we're going to try push for criminal investigation against the army and the two men in question. And it's enormous concern. We are taking legal action.
I want to go back to Jaisley and the picture that we began with of her, that beaming smile that she had in her military uniform. You mentioned she was so driven and ambitious, but I wonder what she would think of you taking this stand and your family standing alongside you all through these past years.
I know that she'd be so proud of what we're doing. She'd be so, so proud.
Leanne McCready there speaking to me earlier. If you have had any experiences of life as a woman in the military, do get in touch with us here on Woman's Hour. You can text us 84844. On social media, it's at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. Also, I want to say, if you've been affected by this story, details of organisations offering information and support are available at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Now, I want to turn to a renowned classical soprano. It is Fatma Saeed. She was the first Egyptian soprano to perform on La Scala's famous stage in Milan. She was also a BBC Radio 3 New Generation artist, a Gramophone Young Artist of the Year. She made her BBC Proms debut, that was 2019. And she's performed alongside Elton John and Ed Sheeran. And one more, which I loved watching, she became the first female artist to perform at the Grand Egyptian Museum in 2023. She sings in six languages. She has an eclectic mix of genres. El Noor was one of her albums that celebrated her cultural heritage. Kaleidoscope featured everything from opera to Whitney Houston. But now her latest album is Lieder. She turns to 19th century German romantic music. Fatma, welcome to Woman's Hour.
Hi, Nuala. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk a bit about your upbringing. You grew up in Egypt, but there wasn't, you say, a tradition of classical Western music.
No, I was listening to all possible things in Cairo, but not classical music at home. We listened to a lot of pop music, a lot of traditional Arabic music. So I was very influenced by this music in general. And I do believe that it had a big influence on my classical singing as well.
So you moved at the tender age of 14, you moved to Berlin to pursue opera. Tell me a little bit about that change in your life and how you convinced your family to go.
That was a very big change in my life because my parents, and they did not leave at that age to study abroad. They left when they did their postgraduate studies. So it was a very big step to let their firstborn daughter go like that and live alone, not to study medicine or engineering, but study music and art, something that none of my family has studied before, no member of my family has studied before. So that was also quite quite an adventure for them as much as it was for me. But I'm very grateful because they wanted me very much to study something that I love, no matter the outcome. And I'm very grateful for my dad, who actually was my biggest support at that point in time, who saw how much I loved it and wanted to actually take such a big risk and let me go.
Where did the love of opera come from, if you weren't really brought up with it in your background?
I would say the love of opera came at a later stage. The love of opera came when I started studying music. The love of classical music and Lieder particularly, mm-hmm. we'll speak about it later, came when I was at, or I felt it when I was at school. I was 14 years old, and my school put a very strong emphasis on classical music education. And I do remember that I was 14 and I was already singing songs by Schumann and Schubert and Mozart. And I loved the poetry. I loved this combination of beautiful poetry coming along with amazing composition by German composers of the 19th century. It moved me a lot, and I think this is when it all started.
And I mentioned this is your new album, Lieder. Let's listen to a clip. This is Widmung from Robert Schumann. Why did you pick this for part of your album?
I find the text of this this song very moving. It was also the song that Robert Schumann wrote for Clara Schumann for their wedding day. So it's very it's very emotional, and it says you my soul, you my heart, you my joy, and you my pain. It's it shows love in all its forms in a way, and I find it very moving. First of all, because of the story behind it, why it was written, but I think also what Schumann has made out of the text of Rückert, simply brilliant.
Okay, let's listen to a little. Beautiful. I want to play another clip from this album. This is Mendelssohn instead. And Hexenlied?
Yes.
And I was looking a little into it, and it talks about, you know, paganism and the rites of spring. I think a lot of us are waiting for spring to explode right now after so many grey days and grey skies.
Yes, it's. I think it's a very nice contrast also to Schumann, because it shows my singing in a different way on the album. The way Mendelssohn has composed the song, he basically put almost a word on every note he put there. So it's very spoken. I wanted to speak it in a singing way, not sing it in a speaking way. And I think also this very dramatic piano introduction and this very bold and direct text makes it a very dramatic song. And it shows Mendelssohn's ability to capture this very mysterious and exotic world of the supernatural that existed in the 19th century. And that was a very strong theme of the 19th century romantic period.
Yeah, witchcraft is in there too. Let's listen to a little. So different. Also, the energy is there, Fatma, as we listen to you. And I was wondering, because you perform in several languages, 6 at my last count, does the feeling change depending on the language that you're singing in?
I do think so. I think every language puts me in a different mood, because the way you pronounce them is very different, and the way you express, I think, love or pain in different languages is also different. In every era, actually. So the way you would talk about love in France in the 19th century is not the same way you talk about love in Germany in the 19th century. And I think that the way I sing is definitely different, because the images I have in my head and the way I came to understood the text and the way I came to understood the way of interpretation of these poets at that time becomes different when I read more about that. So it definitely changes, and I think that's the beauty of singing songs from different times.
How interesting that image of images in your head as you sing. Now, I mentioned you performed Maser Hea Omi at the top of the program. Egypt is my mother. Is that a good translation?
Egypt is my mother.
Uh-huh. So it's a patriotic song. You're performing this at the Grand Egyptian Museum, as we can imagine, just stupendous, as you were surrounded by artifacts from Egypt. That video of you has now been watched at least 2.5 million times. And you not only sing, you dance with a stick. Tell me a little bit what it was like. I just want to tell people the crowd was black tie, ladies in fur jackets. What would I say? I suppose those upper echelons of society. But you managed to get them to sing along and clap and get to their feet.
I'm quite surprised that this video reached you, actually, and that you saw it and that you saw the dance. And it's nice you mentioned this last thing you said about the audience and what they were wearing. I think it says a lot about the Egyptian audience, because as much as it was a classical concert and everyone was coming expecting to listen to classical music and have this kind of, you know, approach to a classical concert that people usually have if they go to a Wigmore Hall or wherever. But the moment I held the stick and actually danced, because that was a moment where I was saying myself, give me the stick to
show you. And that's a traditional Egyptian dance.
Exactly. And the music was actually very traditional, where the tabla, which is the Egyptian original traditional percussion, comes in. That's the moment when I suddenly found the audience extremely engaging and also showing this very traditional side of them, which was very beautiful. It was suddenly, let's forget about this very classical approach and appearance, and let's become Egyptians together. And it was beautiful to unite through the dance with the stick.
It's fantastic. People can't stop smiling and laughing. You did a wonderful job. Fatma Said, thank you for joining us on Woman's Hour. Her album Leader is out now. I want to take a moment to read messages. Louise: as I was meeting the Queen at St. James's Palace, I splashed out on a beautiful suit. The lady standing next to me being presented was wearing the exact same suit. We all, including the Queen, laughed and commented we obviously had good taste. But I got another one from Julia. I was lucky enough to go to the Queen's garden party. When I was queuing for my cucumber sandwiches, I glanced down the line and there was five of us in the same outfit. Great taste. So those two ladies, they met together. Join Anita tomorrow talking about paddle, the sport, and speaking to the musician Rory. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
I was definitely too young when I was leader of the opposition, not to do many of the other jobs I did in government.
Admissions and insights from the people who shape how we think.
I would say my family, well, gave myself and my two siblings a critical eye.
And because it's not just politicians who mould our lives, we also hear from economists, comedians and best-selling authors.
It's the fastest way to change things. You do need politics, but if you want to change something overnight, culture is the quickest way to do it.
Conversations, not newsy interrogations. That's Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.